Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the continuing fallout from the release of the Pandora Papers from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and speak with Frank Vogel, a former senior World Bank official and foreign business and economics correspondent for The Times of London, who currently teaches at Georgetown University. He is the chair of the board of directors of the Partnership for Transparency Fund and the co-founder and former vice chair of Transparency International, the global non-governmental anti-corruption organization, and the author of the forthcoming book out next month, The Enablers: How the West Supports Kleptocrats and Corruption, Endangering Our Democracy. We'll discuss whether the White House Summit on Democracy, scheduled to take place in December, will be a victory for U.S. leadership in fighting corruption abroad, as well as a forum to address the urgency of containing enablers at home. Then we'll speak with Patrick Wyman, who holds a PhD in history from the University of Southern California. He previously worked as a sports journalist covering mixed martial arts and boxing from 2013 to 2018, and his work has been featured in Deadspin, The Washington Post, Bleacher Report, among others, and he's currently the host of the podcast Tides of History, and previously the host of Fall of Rome, and the author of the new book just out, The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. And we will discuss his article at The Atlantic, Trump and the American Gentry, which explores a less exalted and less discussed group, one that sits at the pinnacle of the local hierarchies that govern daily life for tens of millions of Americans. Among the January 6th crowd, there were people who had flown to the event on private jets, since Trump had courted the support of this American gentry, the salt-of-the-earth millionaires who see themselves as local leaders in business and politics, the unappreciated backbone of a once great nation. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is a former senior World Bank official and foreign business and economic correspondent for The Times of London, who currently teaches at Georgetown University. He's the chair of the board of directors of the Partnership for Transparency Fund and the co-founder and former vice chair of Transparency International, the global non-governmental anti-corruption organization. And he's the author of the forthcoming book out next month, The Enablers: How the West Supports Kleptocrats and Corruption, Endangering Our Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Vogel.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Frank. And this week, of course, the Pandora Papers were released by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. This has followed the Panama Papers and then the Paradise Papers. So this is very much a kind of cat amongst the pigeons in terms of having foreign leaders scramble to make excuses for why the King of Jordan needed to buy three Malibu beachfront mansions for $68 million, and the Czech Prime Minister, who ran on a campaign, an anti-corruption campaign against elites, of course, has a $23 million chateau on the French Riviera. So, short of embarrassing these people, I take it your concern is that systemically this whole problem has to be addressed, as opposed to naming and shaming. Not that that's not useful.
Well, first of all, I think all of these papers, all of these disclosures are tremendous. They focus the mind, they get the public interested. When you name big names like the King of Jordan, that has this impact of making this taking this from the bottom of the financial pages right up to the front page, even onto the evening TV news, and of course radio. And that's great. What is very important is that we understand that all of these disclosures amount to the tip of the iceberg. We are seeing today in the world a parallel universe of dirty money, of money that flows through the global financial system, coming from Russia, coming from China, coming from basically about 100, maybe 120 countries that are run today by authoritarian leaders. And all of those authoritarians are kleptocrats, meaning they steal money from their people. And then they have to invest it. And the latest Paradise Papers shows you some of the routes they take. And in addition to those kleptocrats, we have organized crime trying to park its money. And then we have lots of individuals who are very wealthy who try to evade taxes. So that's, if you will, the big picture. And what we need to understand, and we'll get into this, I'm sure, is why should we care?
Well, in terms of the big picture, is the problem then that wealthy individuals avoiding their taxes and big multinational corporations also avoiding taxes commingle their funds offshore with these kleptocrats and criminals, and that they are a powerful lobby?
I would not include most Western multinational corporations in that. What the big companies like Apple and Starbucks and others have done is to look around the world and see which country basically has the lowest levels of corporate tax. So they indulge in what we can call tax avoidance. They escape U.S. tax and other taxes in other countries where they have business that may be very high tax rates, by going to countries like Ireland, for example, that has a very low rate. So the U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has proposed that globally there should be a 15% minimum corporate tax. It's going to be tough to get that passed by the Congress and passed in other countries, but that's the goal. And that would reduce tax avoidance. What we're really talking about in the Paradise Papers and the Panama Papers is in part tax evasion. That's criminal. That's perpetrated by organized crime groups. It's perpetrated by very wealthy individuals, for the most part, who just don't like paying taxes and find essentially illegal ways to avoid doing so in the hope that they wouldn't be caught. But even the tax evasion amounts are relatively, my guess, and it's a guess, relatively small compared to the incredible amounts of money that are stolen by government leaders in many, many countries and then laundered into real estate investments, into master artworks, into super yachts, and most of all, into the shares and bonds securities on the New York Stock Exchange, the London Stock Exchange, and so on.
So then, Frank, and by the way, I think you mean to call it the latest ones, the Pandora Papers, not the Paradise Papers. But,
yes, that's right.
So is that to say then that I'm looking here for the villains, even though the villains are, of course, you've made clear who they are, these kleptocrats and these gangsters.
Let me just jump in for 1 second. In the Pandora Papers, they mention the children of the president of Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan, a former a country that was formerly in the Soviet Union in Central and Eastern Europe, the capital is Baku, and Azerbaijan is very rich in oil. The ruling president is a man called Aliyev. The ruling vice president is his wife. He came to power about 18 years ago, having succeeded his father, who from the time that communism collapsed in 1990 ruled the country. The Pandora Papers point out that the children of President Aliyev have properties, multi-million dollar properties all over the world. Now, let me say why that's just the tip of the iceberg. About $250 billion was laundered over the last 8 years through a major bank in Denmark called the Danske Bank. Of that amount, most came from Russia, but a certain amount, several billion dollars at least, came from Azerbaijan. A couple of years ago, the wife of a major Azerbaijani banker was criminally charged in London because she owned numerous houses and couldn't explain where she got the money from. These are multi-million dollar houses in London. And what tipped the fraud squad off was the fact that she'd run up an account of $16 million at Harrods department store in London, a very fashionable department store. If you look into Azerbaijan, you see a vast array of money laundering activities all over the world. In other words, the people of Azerbaijan are being ripped off by their government leaders who are stealing the money, then investing it in the US, in the UK, and elsewhere. At the same time, they're jailing journalists who criticize them or investigate them. And at the same time, believe it or not, the United States is supplying them with what in the last couple of years has been $100 million worth of arms, supposedly because Azerbaijan can help us against Iran. I'm not quite sure how that works, but that's the excuse. In other words, the relationships between the US and Azerbaijan are very complicated. They involve arms sales, but they also involve huge flows of dirty money into our country. That's just one example in a vast sort of tableau of dirty money examples that amounts in total to probably about $2 trillion a year, of which maybe one third, maybe $600 billion a year comes into the United States. And let's just understand what that means. Walmart is the biggest retail company in the world. Walmart has sales of about $500 billion. In other words, the dirty money coming into America every year is more than the total sales of Walmart alone.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Vogel, a former senior World Bank official and foreign business and economics correspondent for the Times of London, who currently teaches at Georgetown University. He's the chair of the board of directors of the Partnership for Transparency Fund and the co-founder and former vice chair of Transparency International, the global non-governmental anti-corruption organization. He is the author of the forthcoming book out next month, The Enablers, How the West Supports Kleptocrats and Corruption, Endangering Our Democracy. So let's talk, Frank, about the wealth protection industry, because in many ways it feels like we are returning to a sort of global kind of feudalism where you have a sort of vast, you know, underclass around the world who are having their horizons limited by the theft of the cream of their countries, whether it's in Africa or in Asia and other parts of the world. And then you have something, I mean, Oxfam recently had a report, there was like 85 families control half of the wealth in the world. So at the top, you've got this small cadre of billionaires and kleptocrats. And then underneath that, you've got this layer of accountants and lawyers, the wealth protection industry. And then below that, you've got this vast roiling underclass. Is that the direction in which we're heading globally?
I think we're there. And I think if you think about it in those global terms, then we have to be very worried about security issues. We have to be worried about democracy itself, because some of these authoritarian leaders who are kleptocrats, who are stealing funds, such as Russia, such as China, such as Iran, are also using some of those funds to try and undermine elections here, just very recently in Germany. So we have that concern. We have concern that this dark money universe could destabilize the world economic system. But I think you're right. But I'd like to, if I may, both go back into something that you really touched upon, which is so important. As the kleptocrats get richer, as a result, many people suffer. And we have to be concerned about the victims of all of this corruption and of this dirty money, because there are literally hundreds of millions of people around the world in countries that are fundamentally rich with large natural resources, whether it's in Angola, whether it's in Nigeria, whether it's in Azerbaijan, as I just mentioned, oil-rich countries where millions of people are starving. And how bad is this? The group I work with, the Partnership for Transparency Fund, we've just done a project in Moldova to help civil society there understand where budgets go. And in that project, we found that half the money that was allocated for COVID relief, for COVID healthcare relief for the poor, just disappeared. It was clearly stolen. We see that in many, many countries. Now, the second tier that you mentioned is also very important. These are these financial people who manage these funds. Because if you think about it, if you are Vladimir Putin sitting in your palace in Russia, you don't know how to manage the details of money. You trust others to do it for you, and you pay them very well. And the global enablers, as I call them, as the title of my book is, are bankers. They are hedge funds, private equity funds, auditors, real estate brokers, art dealers, and so forth. And in most cases, the enforcement of anti-money laundering laws against those categories of people, these enablers who sit on Wall Street and they sit in London, and they sit in Zurich, is very, very lax. And so they get away with it. And we are talking about colossal sums of money. Last year, Goldman Sachs paid many billions of dollars in fines for having been caught for providing the government of Malaysia with $6 billion, of which $4.5 billion was stolen. The former prime minister of Malaysia alone was found to have $800 million in his private bank account. This was money that Goldman Sachs was raising for economic development in Malaysia. But executives of Goldman Sachs were in cahoots with criminals around the president, the prime minister of Malaysia, and $4.5 billion went missing. This is happening too often, and we have to take action against the enablers. And we can, because they're on our shores. Our government could act, and I think should act. And that's the main thrust of the book I've written, which is about how we really address these enablers.
So let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing our conversation with Frank Vogel, the author of the new book out soon, The Enablers, How the West Supports Kleptocrats and Corruption Endangering Our Democracy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with Frank Vogel, the former senior World Bank official and foreign business and economics correspondent for the Times of London, who currently teaches at Georgetown University. He's the chair of the board of directors of the Partnership for Transparency Fund and the co-founder and former vice chair of Transparency International, the global non-governmental anti-corruption organization. And he's the author of the forthcoming book out next month, The Enablers, How the West Supports Kleptocrats and Corruption, Endangering Our Democracy. And the book is being published on the eve of President Biden's White House Summit for Democracy. And I believe the Secretary of State's also organizing a lot of countries to start focusing on what we're talking about here today, Frank. And of course, the recent release by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists of the Pandora Papers has certainly brought this international dark money sort of alternative universe, if you will, hidden economy into the light. Is there an inherent problem, though, in the sense that the only countries that are likely to do anything and clean up their act are the advanced democracies, even though they've got they're not exactly clean themselves, whereas there's no way you're going to get Putin and Erdogan and Duterte and all of these crooks around the world and the Chinese Communist government itself. They're not going to join any kind of anti-corruption regime, surely.
It's going to be tough. It has been tough. 30 years ago, together with a couple of friends, I started a group called Transparency International. That's a non-governmental anti-corruption group. We now operate in 100 countries, which means that there are very courageous individuals in 100 countries who are leading protests, who are leading public demonstrations, who are leading major efforts to expose the corruption in their countries. You have people like Alexei Navalny, who's in prison in Russia for highlighting corruption in the Putin regime. We've seen dozens of protests around the world. Some have had benefits. Many have not yet had traction. But you have to keep hoping that speaking truth to power will make a difference. Let me make one final point on this. The Summit for Democracy is incredibly important, and President Biden has put anti-corruption front and center on the agenda. But we can't just sanction Putin and sanction the Chinese and sanction people abroad if we don't also address those institutions, those banks and others, who aid and abet the Putins of this world who are resident in our country. And the problem is they exert a great deal of political influence. The amount of influence that the financial community in the U.S. has in influencing political campaigns, in donating to campaigns, in influencing regulation, allows a situation that you see today in the Pandora Papers, where enormous amount of vehicles are used to hide dirty money in South Dakota, in Delaware, in Nevada, and so on. We have to address the problem at home as well as addressing and putting pressure on the Putins of this world and encouraging civil society activists all over the globe to keep on protesting, keep on demonstrating courage, and we have to support them. And I hope most people will.
So should there be then a campaign about these banks and these big kind of white shoe law firms, the enablers? You mentioned in your book that Senator Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, declared when HSBC, the big money laundering probe into that bank, went public under Attorney General Eric Holder, that, quote, are the banks just too big to jail? And obviously joining the list, of course, is the French bank PNB Paribas. They laundered $6 billion in stolen cash for the former president of Sudan. And then Deutsche Bank, of course, was fined enormously a few years back for enabling laundering money for Mexican drug cartels. So there's an awful lot of examples out there, aren't there? So what kind of regime could you put in place to make sure that the bankers aren't too big to jail?
I think there are two key points. First of all, let's go back to the subprime mortgage crisis. Millions of Americans lost their homes. The biggest banks in this country were fined enormous sums. Bank of America paid a $16 billion fine for fraud and for all of the alleged activities that went into that subprime crisis. JP Morgan Chase paid $13 billion as a fine. But none of the CEOs, none of the chairmen of these banks was ever held personally accountable. They not only were not prosecuted, but they were not fired even by their boards of directors. And now when you see all the money laundering that's gone on and perpetrated by so many of the banks, once again, the absolute top executives of these banks seem to have impunity. They seem to be immune from prosecution. They even seem to be immune from even losing their jobs. Their institutions commit crimes, and time and time again, the top bankers say, oh, this was a rogue trader, this was a rogue executive. But it's just too much, and the amounts of money are too much. So we need much more rigid law enforcement. We need new laws as well to make the top executives personally responsible for these kinds of activities, which I think would concentrate their mind. But we need something else as well. We need the leaders of the financial community to ask themselves, is short-term profit maximization the only priority they have? Or shouldn't they also be supporting the public interest? And right now, the public interest is not in aiding and abetting Vladimir Putin to steal money and invest it in the US through all sorts of shell companies and so on. It's not in supporting the Chinese to become ever richer through very shady mechanisms. The public interest needs to be served by our biggest financial institutions. And I think that's an area where we could ask for voluntary action by the banks, so that we don't only seek to press them through new laws, but we also ask them to consider what serves the interests of Americans and, in fact, of democracy. And I believe that we could go back to a time when bankers were much more concerned about the public interest than they are today. And one of the key messages of my book is to remind people that there was such a time, and we need to go back there. So I'm not only calling for new laws, I'm also calling for a resetting of the moral compass of the financial community.
And to take the example of the UK, after the poisoning of the Skripals by the Russian military intelligence, GRU officers, who quickly identified the government, Theresa May, vowed to look into all this corruption, and there have been a number of murders of high-ranking Russians as well, with Litvinenko being poisoned by polonium. But it seems that that whole idea of looking into all the dirty money that comes into the UK, particularly laundered through property, it's sort of gone nowhere, and I don't think Boris Johnson is particularly interested in doing anything about it. The Pandora's papers indicate how much the UK property, and particularly in London, is infused by billions of dirty money. And I would assume that property prices for ordinary folk has just gone through the stratosphere. So it surely has a distorting effect, does it not, on the property market and the ability for working people and middle-class people to have housing?
It has an enormous effect. In my book, I talk about London grad, because Russians have seemed to have taken over so much of the most valuable property, and all property prices in London have risen as a result. And many of those foreign-owned properties are lying empty. Whole neighborhoods are devoid of people, or people who only come for a couple of weeks a year. The same is true in Munich in Germany. The same is true in Vancouver, in British Columbia, in Canada, where there's an enormous amount of homes and property owned by Chinese. We could go to many other places like that. In much of Europe, the biggest complaint about all of this dirty money is exactly its impact on real estate prices. Whereas here we've been most concerned about the national security impact, the undermining of our democracy. In much of Europe, it's been quite simply the impact on real estate prices. And you're quite right. The British have said a lot about doing something about it, but they've done very, very little. And I'll give you just one example. The largest state-owned enterprise in Russia is Gazprom. It's the biggest natural gas producer in the world. There have been numerous books written that say that Gazprom is actually Vladimir Putin's piggy bank, that he takes enormous amounts of money out of it and gets very rich as a result with huge palaces and so on. Gazprom today has raised legitimately over $100 billion in the financial markets, with international investors putting that money in, and who knows where that money has really gone and who facilitates it. Bankers in the City of London, lawyers and auditors in the City of London and in Zurich and in New York, they get high fees. They influence the British government to leave them alone to do what they like. So do the real estate brokers. And today's British government does not seem the slightest bit inclined to disturb basically those who, after all, exert great influence in the corridors of power in London. And I would say right now, we seem to have a similar situation in Washington. But there's hope. For the very first time, we're seeing bipartisan agreement in the Congress to do much more on this front. There are now six bills that have been passed by Republican and Democratic members of the House together that are going to go to the Senate to try to do something to clean up this business. It's not enough, but it's a great start.
But meanwhile, of course, you mentioned earlier, Frank, that $600 billion comes into the country in terms of dirty money. A lot of it goes to South Dakota and to a lesser extent Nevada, and Delaware, of course, has always been the home to the shell companies. What about some law or some mechanism that is able to stop this device that's used by shell companies to disguise who the beneficial owner is? I mean, it doesn't seem like it'd be too complicated to force their hand to make them declare who the actual beneficial owner is.
Yeah, that's such an important point. It's such a good point to raise. The first of all, the money comes through the Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, Delaware, Nevada, South Dakota, and then it goes somewhere else. Those locations are the ones that facilitate the secrecy by creating trust, by creating companies where you don't have to declare who the owner is. So last year, Republican and Democratic members of the U.S. Congress together put a law into the National Defense Law, which is a huge law about security, which always gets passed. So they snuck it into that law called the Corporate Transparency Act. And that, for the very first time, will make sure that the U.S. Treasury can demand to know who the beneficial owner is of various companies. And the regulations for that are being written right now, and the law should come into effect early next year. But needless to say, there's a lot of lobbying going on. Needless to say, there are many lawyers around who are looking at the fine print of proposed regulations and creating loopholes. And one of the biggest loopholes may be trusts. What is so good about the Pandora Papers and coming out right now, especially, is that they point out that South Dakota has become the home of an enormous amount of trusts that hide the dirty money. And at the moment, it's not clear whether the new regulations on beneficial ownership will include trusts. I hope they do. And certainly the publication of these documents in the last couple of days, this disclosures, is going to help that. And it's a very difficult issue because, you know, as you know, trusts are totally legal in the United States. They are a legal way for the transfer of wealth. But the way in which trust law has been written in South Dakota and in Nevada and in Alaska and in various other states has been to, in fact, become competitive with the British Virgin Islands and the Cayman Islands, where, in fact, the whole purpose of those trusts is to hide dirty money. So we need to have this new law cover the trusts. It's going to be a very, very bitter behind-the-scenes fight. And you can imagine some very high-paid lawyers from Wall Street and Washington, D.C. are working hard to dilute the regulations.
So just in closing, Frank, since you've formed Transparency International and have been working in this field for so long and are so familiar, and this is why We're grateful to be able to speak with you today. Have you ever thought about the kind of psychology of the people, these kleptocrats? I don't understand how, you know, I mean, I know these people are just cruel and horrible people, like the dictator in Zimbabwe, who's, this is the poorest country that's a failed state. He loots it. Of course, the Chinese enable him, of course. And he's known as the crocodile because he, under Mugabe, threw Mugabe's dissidents to the crocodiles. I don't know if there's any point in psychoanalyzing him, but this idea that these individuals have no concern for their own people. They are absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned the daughter of the Angolan dictator who's ostensibly a communist, Isabel dos Santos. She ended up with $2 billion, with 40% of Angolans living on less than $20 a month. So I don't understand the psychology of those people. But on the other hand, I find that the enablers, these lawyers in white shoe companies, these accountants, these wealth protection managers, I find them even more odious because they appear to be sort of good citizens. And in fact, they're just as dirty as the dictators. So I know that there's no point in indulging in amateur psychiatrics, but I'm still curious as to know whether there's a pathology that can be dealt with here.
Well, I met many of them. I met many of those bankers and enablers, and I've also met many of the kleptocrats. I think many of them live in an isolated world where they really believe they are above the law. They really believe that they are somehow so brilliant, so wonderful, and they are so narcissistic too, that they can somehow do whatever they like and steal whatever they like and take whatever money they like, and nobody will truly challenge them. And at the same time, there is a paranoia there. One of the reasons why so many journalists are jailed from Azerbaijan to Egypt to Turkey today, to China, of course, and to many other countries, and so many civil society activists, is because of the paranoia of the leaders. They are constantly looking over their shoulder at who perhaps could replace them, who perhaps would take their place. And for the kleptocrats, what that means is if they lose their positions of power, they don't want to keep their money in their country, because that money would be taken too. So one of the reasons they're laundering all this money out of the country into, you know, Los Angeles super mansions is because in the event that they ever lose power, at least they've got all this wealth overseas. I can't truly try and psychoanalyze them, but I can tell you that we live in a world today where we have the capacity, the technological capacity, the intellectual capacity to do far, far more to alleviate absolute poverty in the world. We can do that in part by directly curbing the activities of those who aid and abet the kleptocrats, and of course, by going after those foreign authoritarian crooked leaders. We must do that. And I think we made a lot of progress in the last 30 years in trying to draw public attention to the issues. But there's no question the amount of dirty money that is going through the arteries of the world's financial system is probably bigger today than ever before. And the amount that Western governments are doing to stop that is unfortunately far, far less than we need to do.
Well, Frank Vogel, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Frank Vogel, who's a former senior World Bank official and foreign business and economics correspondent for the Times of London, who currently teaches at Georgetown University. He's the chair of the board of directors of the Partnership for Transparency Fund and the co-founder and former vice chair of Transparency International, the global non-governmental anti-corruption organization. And he's the author of the forthcoming book out next month, The Enablers, How the West Supports Kleptocrats and Corruption, Endangering Our Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump and the American Gentry, a group Trump has courted, who are the salt of the earth millionaires who see themselves as local leaders in business and politics and the unappreciated backbone of a once great nation.
Our values are under attack now, and the bad guys get the benefits. The rest of us pay their way. Patriots are under attack just for having their say. While I'm riding down Freedom Road, agents on my tail. You wave a flag on Christmas Day, they'll throw you in jail.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Patrick Wyman, who holds a PhD in history from the University of Southern California. He previously worked as a sports journalist covering mixed martial arts and boxing from 2013 to 2018, and his work has been featured in Deadspin, The Washington Post, Bleacher Report, among others. Currently the host of the podcast Tides of History, and previously the host of Fall of Rome. He is the author of the new book just out, The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Trump and the American Gentry. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Wyman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Patrick, there was a study done at the University of Chicago recently about profiling the people who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th. And even though we saw this kind of riffraff of lowlifes who desecrated and defecated in the seat of government in the United States, carrying the Confederate flag, which we had a civil war to prevent that from happening, that seems to be the focus. But this University of Chicago study indicated that a lot of those people that stormed the Capitol were the kind of people that you've written about in your article at The Atlantic, Trump and the American Gentry.
Yeah, one of the things that I think gets lost, not just in our discussion of January 6th, but of the Trump's base more generally, is that these are people who, for the most part, live not in the major metropolitan areas, but in the exurbs and the smaller rural areas of the United States. And it's not that they're poor. It's not necessarily that they're working class in an economic sense, but that they code that way to people who live on the coasts, people who don't spend their time looking at things like pickup trucks and Carhartts, and the kind of material language of wealth in these places. It can code as something much more blue collar than it actually is. It's not necessarily a lack of wealth. There's a lot of money in the United States. It's not all concentrated on the coasts, and it may look different depending on where you're looking.
So how does this fit into Jacob Hacker's notion that America has become awash with plutocratic populism?
So I think that this should be something of a corrective to that, in the sense that We do have billionaires. We do have oligarchs. We do have this class of people who exert a great deal of influence in our politics, especially on a national level. You have the Koch network. You have a plethora of billionaires funding foundations and pouring money into political action committees and elections. But there is also another kind of political power in the United States that resides in the hands of people who are much more local, and that's what these gentry are. They are defined by the fact that they own property. They own businesses in these localities that make up a huge chunk of the United States. And by virtue of their power in those communities, by virtue of the wealth that they hold, the people that they employ, the fact that they sit on local philanthropic boards, that they fund local elections, that these are people who exert an outsized influence on things like local zoning, water rights, what gets built where, who has access to which local services. And for a lot of Americans, that's the kind of thing that has a much greater impact on their daily life than who happens to be sitting in the White House or who's sitting on the Supreme Court. It's just a different kind of power, and it's one we're much less used to thinking about.
Well, one of the anomalies, of course, in the U.S. is how, going back to the Founding Fathers, they were concerned that the rural states, and of course the country was expanding at that time, expanding west, wouldn't have the same kind of representation as the more developed urban states on the East Coast. So this has led to this kind of bias towards red states, which is certainly affects the Electoral College, giving these small states advantages since they get two senators. Wyoming has two senators and what, half a million people or something, and the California has two senators and, what, 40 million. So that is an existing problem here, and it indicates that the Republicans have an advantage in controlling the Senate and the Electoral College in perpetuity. So how much does what you've written about in terms of Trump's American gentry, are they in red states and are they the kind of backbone of this red state imbalance?
So I think that they are the backbone of the Republican Party's political class, to the extent that the Republican Party is a class as a kind of a sociological phenomenon. Its leadership, or not necessarily its leadership, but the people that it is electing to offices are disproportionately business owners. They are members of this gentry class. They're car dealers, beverage distributors, people who are big deals in their local communities or are adjacent to the big people in their local communities. When you look at Republican the state legislatures that are crammed with Republicans that are a product of this same kind of bias toward rural areas at the expense of the urban, they are crammed full of people like this. So when we talk about the kind of the sociology of power and the expectation, the cultural expectations of politics that go along with that, they are in large part derived from this class of people. It's not just a matter of kind of system design, but also political culture and the way in which that is tied into the social groups from which you're drawing your political class. And this is in large part the financial base of the Republican Party, but also the group from which it draws huge numbers of its actual politicians.
And again, I'm speaking with Patrick Wyman, who holds a PhD in history from the University of Southern California. He previously worked as a sports journalist covering mixed martial arts and boxing from 2013 to 2018. And his work has been featured in Deadspin, The Washington Post, Bleacher Report, among others. He's the host of the podcast Tides of History and previously the host of Fall of Rome. And he's the author of the new book just out, The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Trump and the American Gentry. So I'm a little puzzled, and I'm sure you'll set me right, Patrick, but Trump has taken over the Republican Party, even though he's a manifestly failed president. It's extraordinary what's happening now. He seems to be curiously more powerful than ever. And we have a situation in this country where something like 80% of Republicans believe that Trump should still be the president and that Biden is an interloper. And they are engaged in massive voter suppression, which could enable them, starting in 2022 and 2024, to become essentially turn America into a one-party state. So you're describing the kind of traditional Chamber of Commerce-type Republicans who I thought were all but extinct and that the party had been taken over by this sort of rabid bunch of, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greens and Matt Gaetzes and these and Jim Jordans. So set me right if indeed I've got the wrong impression here.
So I don't think there's any contradiction between those two. You know, if you go all the way back to the 1950s and the 1960s, or even before that, to the 1930s, when there was a huge chunk of the Republican Party that was terrified of FDR and socialism, the people who were funding the John Birch Society in the 50s and the 60s, all the way up to 2012, the people who at the Republican National Convention were chanting, "We built this," in contradiction to Barack Obama saying, "You know, you didn't build this. This is kind of a joint project of our whole society." I don't think there's any actual contradiction between those two things. You can be a successful local business person. You can even totally rational in the way that you run your business and still be an absolutely rabid, frothing at the mouth reactionary. Those two things are not mutually exclusive at all. I think we tend to idealize the category of business owner in the United States, and especially the successful business owner, as an ideal type that stands for, you know, community and justice and, you know, making sure that a 16-year-old gets that first opportunity to have their first job. But there's not necessarily any contradiction between that and also believing that that the central government of the country has been stolen from the deserving people like you who should be making the choices about who's president.
So would this group of people then be okay with this country following the path of Hungary's Orbán, you know, the idea of electoral autocracy, which is what is happening in the real world today with all of these Republican bills being passed in state legislatures. The amount of gerrymandering that's going on is such that the Republicans could pick up the House in 2022 before any votes are cast.
So I think the key thing that you have to look at, and let's take a step back here, is to think about what Trump's appeal was. And I think at a really basic level, in terms of his affect, the reason why this class of people loved him and continues to love him is because he was just openly hierarchical in the way that he understood the world and in his appeal. Trump's appeal was based on the fact that some people are better than others in that particular way of understanding the world. That whether that's economic or whether that's racial or whether it's based on where you live, that some people are better than others. Some people are kind of natural superiors. And I think you can see the appeal of that way of thinking about the world to people who think of themselves as the best of their local communities. That, you know, that every local member of a local gentry could look at Donald Trump and see somebody who yeah, you know, he's right. Some people are better than others. We are the ones who should be in charge. And I think that kind of authoritarian, kind of illiberal democracy that is espoused by the Orbán types is perfectly of a piece with that. If you believe that some people are more deserving than others, if that some people are better than others, then it's not a huge step to go from there to, well, they shouldn't be allowed to participate at all, or their votes don't count. We're the real Americans here. I mean, I think that's one of those refrains that you hear over and over, real Americans versus not real Americans. It's an exclusionary thing. And I think that fits very neatly with a world in which these people are wielding local power of an economic and political type that, you know, it's easy to look at yourself and say, well, really, you know, my employees' votes should not count for as much as mine do.
Right. And that is reflected in even a moderate Republican, Mitt Romney's, when he was running, when they had that clandestine tape of him at a Republican fundraiser addressing his donors, talking about where the makers and they're the Democrats, the takers. That's a fairly common mindset. So just to put a face on what you're talking about, Patrick, the couple that were waving their AR-15 and the pistol at the Black Lives Matter demonstrators in St. Louis, are they the kind of people you're talking about?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think in that specific case, they're lawyers, but they're extremely wealthy lawyers with property interests. And I think that's the thing that defines this group of people, is that they're propertied and they're local. Like those folks there, the ones who were waving the guns at the protesters, are defined by the fact that they are St. Louis wheelers and dealers, right? That they are present in that place. They wield power there. That's what makes them gentry. They are rooted. And I think that's the important thing to understand about this. We're so used to thinking of all politics as national. And to some extent, you know, our politics are national, but there is also this enormous local component to people's lives and to the politics that define their lives. And we miss that if we don't realize that people like those gun-toting St. Louis folks actually have a lot of power to affect what gets done in ways that shape people's everyday lives.
So since we're on the verge of authoritarianism, with what the Republicans are doing now, and they've clearly made a decision that they don't want to compete and have better candidates and better ideas. They simply, in effect, you can make the case that we are in a new civil war, in the sense that there's a secession underway, that a lot of Americans in Trump world and in the Republican Party have decided to seal them off from the rest of the country, to use minority power through the Supreme Court, through gerrymandering, through the Electoral College, etc., to take the power and not have anything to do with the blacks and the browns and the liberals and the city dwellers and the people that they don't like. That seems to be underway. But the step that Trump's American gentry would take from democratic tradition into neo-fascism, are they aware of that? Would it bother them to take that step?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would bother them all that much, because as much as the United States has democratic traditions, it also has a long series of anti-democratic traditions. And it has a long history of local gentry calling the shots in the places where they live, whether those were kind of bosses in South Texas who were deciding how the people living in their local regions were going to vote. You know, there's the famous case of Lyndon Johnson making one phone call and 96% of the vote switching from his opponent in that particular precinct to 96% for Lyndon Johnson. These people, these local wheeler dealers have always been there. I mean, they're a stronger presence in some regions than others, but they've always been around, and so too has their control over their localities and with a corresponding national influence. So I think as much as there are some very new and frightening things going on in our politics, there are also some strands that go back a long way. You know, we've been fighting this kind of tug of war between Democratic and anti-democratic tendencies in our politics going back all the way to the founding. That is one of the stories of American political history, is this kind of constant back and forth between these two things. So I think there are long traditions to this, even if the manifestations of them and also, quite frankly, the seriousness of those challenges might be different. There's also this long past that we can look to understand that these dynamics have been present for a long time.
So I have to be more precise when I talk about the struggle in America between plutocracy and democracy. It's not just the plutocrats, the Bezoses and the Musks and these extraordinarily wealthy people that have gotten incredibly wealthy during the pandemic, but it's also the American gentry that you write about. And just in closing, you mentioned Lyndon Johnson. He's, of course, a Democrat. Most of the gentry you're writing about, and calling them Trump's gentry, they're Republican, right? Almost exclusively, mm-hmm. aren't they?
Yeah, I would say probably 75, 80, 85% of them were voting for Trump, yeah.
So just in closing then, what about the majority in this country? Are we destined for minority rule? Have we always had minority rule? Can the majority assert itself in America?
So I think the key is that you've got to look for venues in which the majority can exert its power. So I think the labor movement is one of those. One of the greatest counters to the rule of this kind of gentry is by giving their employees counterweights. You are effectively reducing their profit margins by forcing them to pay their employees more. I think that creates a counterweight, and it does so on a vast scale. So you've got to empower people at an economic level before you can ever empower them politically. The kind of local inequality that makes these people elites, you've got to reduce that if you're ever going to reduce their political influence and their political power. It's got to start there. That's kind of fundamental to this whole deal, is that it's not just the politics. It's also the politics as an expression of material conditions, of underlying material conditions. And so that means not just looking at it at a national level, but also what's happening in these localities between these people and the folks that they employ, between these people and their communities, the role that they play in terms of, you know, providing basic social services as philanthropy, that you've got to cut them out of that if you're going to try to fight them, if you're going to try to fight the power and influence that they have and, you know, the kind of the backbone of an approaching authoritarianism, then you've got to fight the material conditions that make them powerful, too.
Well, Patrick Wyman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Patrick Wyman, who holds a PhD in history from the University of Southern California. He previously worked as a sports journalist covering mixed martial arts and boxing from 2013 to 2018. And his work has been featured in Deadspin, The Washington Post, and Bleacher Report, among others. Currently, he's the host of the podcast Tides of History, and previously the host of Fall of Rome, and he's the author of the new book just out, The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Trump and the American Gentry. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. When we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate. where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now.